This is episode 100 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host, and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week. Episode 100. I can't believe it's been that many. So many great guests, so much terrific info. My first episode was with my friend Ken Frawley on April 2nd, 2018, the day after April Fool's Day. I remember because it was also a day after my daughter Lily's birthday. By the way, she's the one you always hear on the fun facts and the intro and the outro of Fact or Something John Just Made Up. My idea was to have my friends on the show and they'd all give us all sorts of info on what's made them successful. But then something magical happened. The people I had on kept referring me more and more names of very successful variety artists. Most I didn't even know. I'd only heard about and read about them in magazines and on TV. So thanks to you, I've been able to live my dream. Meeting all these folks and finding out what makes them tick has been life-changing. I'm glad you've been able to come on this journey with me. Thanks to every guest for the great referrals. And a special shout out to my friends Hal Myers, aka Damien, and David Aiken, the checkerboard guy. You went above and beyond by referring lots and lots of your close performing friends. I appreciate it. Now, along the way, we here at the Variety Artist Podcast created an entire website with more resources than you could ever use. There's every single book suggested by every single one of my guests. There's a cool store with t-shirts and mugs and inspiring sayings from your favorite guests. And most importantly, there's 100 interviews from top pros in the biz. Everyone I interviewed was honest and held nothing back. They all gave great advice, terrific info, and tell amazing stories. So here it is, episode 100. To celebrate number 100, I have someone very special for you. He's worked with just about every famous comedian you can think of. He has his own foundation and donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to his favorite charities. He even gives credit to his lovely wife, Lori, at the end of this interview. The perfect way to celebrate number 100. Enjoy the show, and thanks again for coming on this journey with me. I can't wait to see what's in store for the next 100.
Fun fact number 323. John accidentally wandered onto the set of a famous sitcom thinking it was the producer's office.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He was voted both Parlor Magician of the Year and Comedy Magician of the Year by the Academy of Magic Arts. He's one of the funniest magicians ever to grace any stage and a personal hero of mine. Variety Artist, I give you Michael Finney.
Thank you so very much for the nice intro, man.
Now, I first became aware of you at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach.
You know, that is a place that I definitely can say I got my start in L.A. I don't know who took me there. I don't know how I got there. I don't know if I went there on my own or what, but I did get a chance to audition. I met a lifelong friend, Doug Zeton, there, and I met Don Barnhart, who's a comedy comedian, hypnotist guy up in Vegas. I mean, that's where I started. I had a couple of friends that did comedy, and they knew I was doing comedy nights trying. I had gone back to tending bar a little bit, part-time, just to make sure I had enough money to take care of, you know, Lori and I. But I wasn't sure if I was going to continue on in magic, and I ended up in L.A. doing an open mic night. Some people set up some open mic nights for me, just said, go here, go here, go here, do it. I did it. I came home, and I started getting phone calls. So, but it definitely, if I was to put it down in my history books, it would have been the Comedy and Magic Club gave me my first chance.
Well, that's a great place. So when I saw you, you were just starting out in the 80s, early 80s, I suppose?
Early 80s, 81, 82-ish. My name was on the wall up there in the brick in the green room for a long time. I don't know if they added a room and it got covered or what, but I actually got to headline that room, and not many magicians did. And I actually headlined that room back in the day. So, yeah, that really helped me a lot. And those people that are still my friends are still helping me to this very day.
Now, you said you were a bartender originally, or you did part-time bartending? How did that work out?
Yeah, people that go way back with me, and I think I've done this in a couple of interviews, but my background is food, beverage, and hospitality. I got into that industry quite by accident. I moved to Phoenix. I didn't know anybody in the state except my father, and I moved there to start over, and I took a job as a midnight bellman in a hotel. I worked my way up in the ranks. They needed a bartender. They taught me how to tend bar. I thought I had, you know, made it. I mean, to be able to have a skill like tending bar and communicating with strangers, little did I know I was laying the groundwork for my comedy magic appearance, my comedy magic presentation. My comedy magic foundation started as a bartender before I ever learned my first magic trick.
So were you trying out jokes and different things on your patrons, on the people that were coming in?
No, because I was a bartender. If you ever watch any of the old black and white movies, the bartender was always the coolest guy. He had a sense of humor. He had a joke, a story. He could always whip up a good drink. He knew the good guys, the cops, and he knew the bad guys. And then he knew those people that managed to live their life in between the cops and the bad guys. So I was just me behind the bar. I would talk, I would chatter. If you had a favorite music group or something back in that day, I made sure I had your cassette CD or to put in the machine so that when you came in, I played the music that you liked. And it was just one of my ways. So to make a long story short, a really nice bartending job opportunity came up, 36 stories high in a French restaurant called the Golden Eagle. And I was the person that they came and offered the job to. So I was pretty happy getting that job. I wore a bow tie, a ruffle shirt, black slacks, and a cummerbund. So I had pretty much my whole magician's outfit before I ever picked up my first magic trick. While working in this bar, the day bartender, Bob Shaw, he served on Iwo Jima. He did magic tricks. He made the lit cigarette disappear, and I saw it, and it blew my mind. And I pestered him for weeks and weeks and weeks, and finally, that old story is the truth. I paid $100 for my first Bernay.
Oh, is that true?
Yep. Best $100 I ever spent on magic.
But it came with knowing how the trick was done, too, huh?
Well, I paid to learn how the trick was done, and I made a heck of a lot more than $100 off of it. Yeah. But it taught me it was a secret. It was a family. It was a fraternity. It was a brotherhood. And by all means, respect just those basic, simple, few little rules.
Yeah.
And one man, just keep the secret. That's all. Let somebody else find out the way you found out.
Yeah.
And I tell people, it's not a secret. Go to the library. Then come back and we'll talk, because everything is in a library and it won't cost you $100.
That's how I learned. I tell this story all the time. I used to go into my local library, which is Gardena. It's in Southern California. And the librarian saw me checking out all sorts of library books on magic and said, "Are you a magician?" And I said, "Oh, yes, of course I am." And she said, "Well, my magician got sick. Can you do a show?" I said, "Yes." And the rest is history. And that was my story.
Yeah.
Was the library.
Yeah. That's it. Exactly. That's it. It's so difficult. If I was to give somebody some advice, maybe especially younger ones, don't give up the books just yet. Even if you're a working professional, don't think it isn't good to go back and look in a book and get a refresher course on something. You've come a long way and you might have a different perspective on it at this point, at least enough to where you'd be able to talk about it with other people and throw around some ideas. So the books, man, go back and refresh yourself. And maybe even look at something you've never even done before.
Something Tom Ogden brought up in a previous interview about books. I'm pretty sure it was Tom Ogden. He was saying that if you check out a book, not only are you looking at that particular effect that you were trying to find in the first place, but you also find a treasure trove of hundreds of tricks, just like you're saying, one or two that you may not have thought of even doing, but then you see it and you go, "Oh, well, that fits my personality."
Yep, because you're constantly evolving. The tricks are going to stay basically the same. The only reason the tricks evolve is because the performer evolves. So that's how it works. The tricks are set in stone.
Yeah.
It's the presentations. And that's where you get to put your own little mark of approval, your own little moniker on it, your own little "this is my presentation." How many people do you know do tons of great rope stuff? I mean,
right.
there's guys out there that do rope stuff I can't even fathom.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of room for everybody's uniqueness. And so that's how my little rope routine made it this far. You know, it's just having that personal touch, who you are.
What made you go on? I remember you on Star Search. What made you go on Star Search?
Well, I had done the magic for a while. 8 months after I learned that cigarette trick, I quit tending bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed at home. I was doing enough private parties for client stuff. In this restaurant was doctors, lawyers, judges, and very rich, influential people. It was just that kind of a place from all around the United States and locally. 36 stories high, doctors, lawyers, judges, in there for lunch, which I was there from 4 in the afternoon until midnight. So I was in there for late lunch, happy hour, and dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So you meet all these people, and then they're going, "Hey, Mike, we're going to have a little party next week at the house. Why don't you come over and tend bar for us? And, hey, bring that little bag of tricks with you." And I did this. I did this for a while. And then I'm a hustler. I mean, there's stuff people will never know. How I got to be where I'm at was because of my previous life. But I'm a hustler. So it didn't take me very long to go, "You know, man, I got to learn some more tricks. I got to get me like a half hour." Then I start going to a magic shop known as Bertie's Lee's Fun Shop. Mm-hmm. I meet Jack Sutherland, who becomes my mentor. He becomes the man that takes me under his wing, like every magician had that one guy.
Yeah.
And he wasn't always the most famous magician in the world. He was just a magician that was a magician that knew his stuff and said to himself, "I could help this person." And that's what Jack Sutherland did for me.
Hmm.
So I'm under his wing, and he's guiding me, and I take his beginning class. I take his advanced class. And when I talk about Jack Sutherland, a few people will know. Harry Anderson will have known. Harry's gone now, but Harry and I had the same mentor. Harry and I were pallbearers at Jack's funeral. Harry is my connection above and beyond with Jack, that Jack took the time to help somebody out. And there's some other guys. Jack's very well known. I fell into the right place. I fell into that place that every magician kid would want to fall into, except I was 24 years old. I wasn't 12 years old. So,
oh, you're old enough, man, to know. I was just putting on Facebook. I did my first magic show at 34 years old. But the nice thing about that is that you have the maturity and that you have the life experience to present something interesting.
Huh? Hopefully, man, I was still a punk green kid, man. I learned so much. I mean, I was so rough around the edges. And I had another mentor. His name was Oki Strom. O-K-E Strom. He was from Sweden. And he taught me stage presence. He taught me, he said, and I've screwed up, but he taught me to try to be as humble with my magic as I could be all of the time. That I was just a guy that learned a few tricks, and oh, by the way, I could perform them. Other than that, I was just a regular schmo, and I should act like a regular schmo, and that's who I am. So rough around the edges to this very day, but with no ill intent.
Yeah. Well, how did this all bring you to Star Search?
The comedians used to give me a lot of grief. I mean, I worked with everybody, man. I got so many breaks. But I worked with Robin Williams. I worked with Richard Belzer, Elaine Boozler, Bob Saget, Bob Coulier.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked with Keenan Ivory Wayans. I worked with all of these guys. And so anyway, some of the younger ones, some of the guys that weren't secure in their status would give me grief. You wouldn't be funny if you didn't have a magic trick in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was on their tails. I was a featured act, and I wanted to be the headliner. I wanted that headliner money. So whenever I went on stage as a featured act, I was going up there to bury that headliner. I didn't want him to follow me. I wanted to be the headliner.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned to present my magic. I developed my character. And at that point, I said, okay, I got to prove to these clowns that I can do straight stand-up. because that's all we are. We're all just clowns.
That's right.
You know, different makeup. And so I dedicated myself to writing straight stand-up. Jay Leno wrote my very first joke for me, which I do to this very day, which is magic-oriented. Working with Jay in 1985, 84 in Houston, Texas at the Laugh Stop, Jay had just got the Doritos commercial, and his career was about to take off. And I was the featured act. He watched me on Tuesday. Wednesday night, he says, hey, you could do stand-up comedy if you wanted to. I said, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, you're just a funny guy. You're a likable guy. You could just get up there and do stand-up. I said, well, I don't even know how to write it. He goes, it's easy. What are you? You're a magician. Okay. As a kid growing up, my favorite trick was being able to make my peas disappear and then reappear on my little brother's plate. And he said to me, he goes, Michael, it's not a belly laugh. It's a chuckle, but it's a beginning. Now take that and run with it. That's a story. Tell a story.
Yeah.
You're a storyteller. You're magic. You're telling a story. So take the stories and tell jokes.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And on Thursday night, I did that joke. It got a chuckle. And then I followed it up with, I wasn't very fond of spinach. And my father would say, Michael, eat all of your spinach. Don't you want to grow up to be just like Popeye? Even at 9 years old, I knew olive oil was a pretty ugly woman. And so that joke came within a matter of 24 hours, and it fit right in, and I was on my way. So I ended up on Star Search as a comedian. I wanted to establish myself as a guy that could get up there, do straight stand-up, not have the privilege of having a magic trick in his hand, but breaking it down to the most common denominator, me, a mic, and my mouth, seeing if I could entertain people.
Yeah.
That's it. Just entertain people. To this very day, people always want to label me. Are you a magician or are you a comedian? I'm an entertainer. And it wouldn't matter if I was a juggler or a singer or a ventriloquist. If I'm an entertainer and I'm a good entertainer, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. I'm entertaining the audience. That's what performers have to get into their mind. Once they get this in their head, they'll stop worrying about other magicians, other entertainers, and they'll focus on themselves and how they can become the best entertainer they can be. That's how it's done.
That's how you've done it and been very successful doing it.
With you know what, with just the minimum amount of help, you know, the right help, the people that helped me, they added all the right things. They told me all the right things, and I was open enough to listen to them, take some really rough criticism in the beginning. I mean, and like I said, I was rough. I deserved it. You have to have somebody open your eyes and really, you got to look at yourself hard and go, okay, if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to change. And that's where change starts, is with the person.
Mm.
And it's difficult. Man, I work on it every day. It's difficult, but it can be done.
Yeah, no, it's hard taking criticism, no matter what stage in your career you are, because it's a dash to your ego. But if you can get rid of that and actually listen to what other people that have been there before you have to say and implement it in your act, you know, you're better off for it.
I think so. I think so. And you know what? I'm going to tell you this real quick.
Sure.
I've gotten a couple of really good pieces of advice from some really younger dudes. You know, some younger people have said to me, hey, we have a conversation. Whatever it was, whether I made them comfortable enough to say, okay, I'm going to tell this dude something. He's either going to like it or he's not. I listen to these other people. You listen to everybody. You
of course.
Give everybody a 2 cents worth, man. They don't cost you nothing.
I've been binging Netflix, and I was watching the Norm Macdonald Show. I don't even know if you know this went on. I was watching the Norm Macdonald Show, and he had on there David Spade. This is actually the reason that I contacted you, is he had David Spade on there, and David Spade was talking about how he was opening, or he opened for Robert Townsend and Sam Kennison at a place called Finney Bones. And when I heard that, he said, oh, you know, the comedy magician, Michael Finney. And I said, oh, I should have him on the show. So what's the deal with Finney Bones?
Well, quite frankly, it was a necessity thing that worked out. At the time, there were no comedy clubs in Phoenix, and Chuckles Comedy Club had closed under really bad circumstances. I mean, let's face it, the 80s, everybody did pretty much what they wanted to, when they wanted to, and the way they wanted to. The owners got greedy, and everybody was out for themselves. A friend of mine, his name is Paul Hopp, he says, man, he goes, I think we could get a club together. And I said, okay, let me see what we can do. I said, you'd have to run it because I'm going to be on the road working, but I think I'll help out. See, so we came up with Finney Bones. I found another investor. He gave me the money, and we opened up Finney Bones at Town and Country Shopping Center. And then we moved. It was only a 110-seat room. We moved to Fifth Avenue and Camelback inside the Days Inn Hotel, 160 people. And we were there a total of 7 years. Mm. And the only reason it closed is because my partner wasn't being fair.
No.
I just said, hey, I'm going to go my separate ways, take my name down, and all is good. No worries. We paid our debt service off in 2 years. Can you imagine if this guy would have just played fair with me where we'd be today?
Yeah.
Things are meant to be, and you just move on. But in that club, man, we had everybody. Sam was there about every 4 or 5 months. Elaine Boozler came there, Rusty Warren. We had Pat Paulson. We had Harry Basil. Every comedian that was my friend at that time that was a headliner in the 80s headlined that comedy club. It was just a great place. And David Spade, he's such a good little guy. You know, he's such a good comedy actor.
He's a good little guy.
Well, you know what? He is. He's small in his size at the time, and I was much bigger. God, I mean, I weighed almost 280 when I first started hanging with Dave, I think. Mm-hmm. And David, you know what I like about David is David picked up his bootstraps, and he went to L.A., and he jumped in that big old bowl and said, I'm going to do it here. I never did that. I stayed in Phoenix, and I was a big fish in this little bowl, and it all worked out. I never thought of myself as a movie star or an actor or anything like that. I just was happy making a living, making people laugh and doing some magic. But David, man, he went over there and he became a star. For him to even mention me, because I mean, really, it's just a little part in his life, but for him to mention me, that's pretty cool. That tells you the kind of person David is.
That is kind of cool.
And I knew Norm. I know Norm from afar. Norm probably wouldn't remember me, but I opened for Norm more than once, and he's a really funny character. And
he does remember you. He mentioned you on the show.
I got to go see this show then.
Well, it's actually a Netflix special. It's called, I think it's called Norm MacDonald Has a Talk Show or something like that.
Okay, that sounds about right.
I don't know if it was canceled or they're not making it anymore. I have no idea. But I saw that and I said, you know, I got to listen to that. I got to watch that. That'll be fun.
You know, I've been so lucky to have been real close to greatness. You know what I mean? I've hung out with those guys that have done good and great things. And to have that friendship, then that means everything was done right when we first met. So that's just, thanks for telling me about that. That's cool.
Oh, sure.
When you get into this business and you do get lucky and you get to certain levels in certain places, you get exposed to really cool things. Ted Hendricks is a NFL Hall of Fame football player.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and did a charity event for him at his thing in Florida. And man, he calls me, he goes, hey, what are you doing? Nothing. Hey, why don't you fly to Miami? I'm going to take you to a Raiders game. They were playing the Dolphins. And so he took me to a Raiders game and I brought my magic and I did stuff in the box for those people. I mean, that's something that you wouldn't expect. It's just a perk of being into this business. But to have opened for, say, in 93 on the Variety Arts Telethon, getting to do an opening spot in front of Ray Charles, I mean,
that's
pretty cool. And so for me, I was always, I don't know, not enamored, but I was always fascinated by celebrity. And so whenever I got a chance to meet him, man, I took that opportunity. whether I was opening for him or if I was just in the same room, to meet these people, like to do magic for Muhammad Ali on his 70th birthday. That's a pretty cool gig, man.
That's a pretty cool gig.
You get to see him up close and personal. I had met him twice before, but the opportunity did not arise for me to do magic. Mm. But in this one situation, I was asked specifically to come and do magic for Muhammad Ali at Elements at Sanctuary, which is in Scottsdale on Camelback Mountain. And the owner of that place is the Cincinnati Reds owner. So yeah, just tell you where how big that money is. But yeah. They did his 70th birthday party, and I got to sit for him specifically right dead in front of me. And he is my guy. That's who I'm doing the magic for. And everybody else is observing him, watching me do magic.
Yeah, also one of my heroes, by the way.
Oh, my God. Oh, I get goosebumps just talking about it.
Oh, man.
Going over to England and being able to perform at the London Palladium, Paul Stone took me there, and being with John Calvert, the first time he ever stepped foot on that stage at 100 years old. I mean, gosh, this magic world, I can't even begin to tell you all the places and the stories and the great things that have happened. You know,
do you have a book or something?
I don't know what I should do. I don't know.
I mean, it sounds like you have so many stories and things that
you're one of a bunch of people, you know, that I kind of respect your opinions, you know, but when it comes to me writing a book, I question your smarts. I mean, I got stories. They would all come out the way I talk. I'm not, real eloquent. I think people have empathy for my lack of intelligence. I don't know, but I try hard, and I got great stories. I'd love to tell you some with magicians and with football, baseball, celebrities. I mean, Chuck Berry, the night I opened for him, what a prince he was. I mean, yeah, every one of these is worthy of a story and a mention, but then I could tell you about guys like AJ, who lives over in LA, and
yeah,
he's a genius, and not many people, more people should know of him. But here's a guy that's just an incredible guy that's worthy of everything I've said about anybody. And then you mentioned Tom Ogden.
Yeah.
Tom was a big star when I first started. Anything Tom says, pretty valid. He's been at this long enough. Him and guys like Martin Lewis and Nick Lewin.
Oh, these are all big names in magic. I had Nick Lewin had a fascinating interview. Yeah, boy, he broke down how to get a standing ovation. And when Nick Lewin talks, you listen.
Yeah, I dare say Nick's guided a lot of guys down that path of success with all of his experience. Anybody that could get 5 minutes with Nick should take it for sure. There's a handful of guys that you do that with, and Nick would be one of them.
Absolutely. Now, do you remember, talking about stories, you remember your best or worst gigs?
Oh, gosh. Most of those times, it wasn't my fault or I wasn't involved in it.
Yeah.
You know, I was just an innocent bystander, and I'm going to – that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Probably the funkiest thing to happen – geez. Pauly Shore, comedian, his mother and parents owned a comedy store,
right.
I think, in L.A., which to this very day, I've never performed in that place. I don't even know if they'd have me.
What happened?
I just never, the opportunity never arose.
Oh.
In my entire life, it never arose, but I'd jump on a chance. But anyway, Pauly was out doing a road trip, and he was traveling in a bus, and he had his little groupies and whatnot. I was headlining the Funny Bone at the time, and they said, hey, just go up and do like 20 or 30 minutes, and Paulie's going to close the show. I said, hey, cool, man.
Yeah,
no problem,
good luck
with that. And so about 10 minutes into my set, a person who did not gauge their alcohol intake properly, nor their consumption of food, greasy in a restaurant, probably at the club, puked.
Oh, no.
And when I say puked, they were sitting in the front row. They had bought tickets extra, paid extra to sit in the front row. When they puked on the table directed at the stage, and it was one of those flat tops round tops. So when it hit, when it came out with the force of a small hurricane, it hit the table and then immediately splashed up onto the stage.
Oh, lovely.
If you threw a bucket of water out and when it hit the ground, it splashed up, that's what this little girl's puke did. And she was little, but man, it was enough for like three people. She was puking up three people puked. And it went everywhere. And I'm like, oh my. And I never saw it coming.
You're in the middle of your act and so, all of a sudden a hurricane hits.
10 minutes and I'm standing. I open up with straight stand up before I do the magic. So I hadn't pulled anything out yet. Right at my feet, upchucked. And I'm one of those people. If I hear you gag, if I hear somebody else throw up, I start throwing up.
Oh, great.
I have this, I've had it since I was a kid. I can't stand to pick up dog crap. You can't be in the same room changing a baby. Oh my God. That's, I mean, I'm just weak. So here I am gagging on the stage. She's gagging from her chair. And, oh, they had to stop the show and it was a mess. Try editing that, John.
Yeah. No, I'm leaving all that in, my friend.
Oh my God.
I actually have a Pauly Shore story. I was doing, is it the Improv in Hollywood? I was performing there.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah. And I was backstage and I do magic with live animals is one of the things that I do. So I see Pauly Shore there. He's not performing, but he's there. So I tell my wife at the time, I said, well, you got to get a picture of me and Pauly Shore and then my chinchilla. Cause I thought it would be a great shot. So I give I'm holding the chinchilla right with Pauly Shore. And it's right when camera phones first came out. My wife didn't know how to work the camera phone. She says, oh yeah, John Paul, yeah, just stand there. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. So she's clicking away and she can't figure out how the phone's working. And Pauly's getting annoyed. And I'm standing there looking at him. He's looking at me. I'm looking at him. We're both looking at the chinchilla. And eventually she gets one shot and he walks away all angry.
Yeah. You know what? If you're a friend of Pauly's, you're okay. If Pauly knows you, everything's fine. But if Pauly doesn't, Pauly thinks pretty good about himself. He liked himself a lot. He's not very congenial. He was less than congenial with me, and I bore the brunt of his appearance. Yeah, it's just people, different days, different strokes, different
folks. He had to follow you too, which I'm sure wasn't the best.
Listen, man, they had to clean the room. They had to clean the stage. You can't get puke smell out in 5 minutes. I don't care if you use bleach. You're not going to get it out. So the show was halted for like 40 minutes to an hour. And meanwhile, Pauly's out in the bus doing whatever Pauly's doing. And he did come in, much to his credit. He did come in about, I would say it had to be at least 10:30, heading to 11. And the show started at 8. So, yeah, it was a mess.
Oh, man. Yeah, this barfing thing, this must be common amongst you and your friends only because I had Ken Scott. In fact, I mentioned right before we got on that I had Ken Scott on a month ago, and he talks about how somebody barfed on his stand-up case in the middle of the show.
Oh, man.
So you guys have that in common. Next time you're with Ken, you guys got to talk about that.
Yeah, it just happens, you know. Part of it's the experiences, and we learn from every experience on stage. So that's the upside. You always take something positive away from it.
Yeah. Now, right now, you're doing making most of your living doing corporate shows.
You know what? Right now, I am having the best time of my life. I'm doing little theaters. I like focusing back on really the magic. For the longest time, it was about entertaining people with my comedy and my magic at the same time and just throwing it out there at them, man. And nowadays, I've done Marvin's Theater in Palm Springs. I've done Mystique Dining, which most guys would go, you did that? Yeah, I did it, and I had fun, and I'm going back. I did the House of Cards. And what I'm alluding to is these smaller rooms, 60, 80, 70, 100 people maybe,
yeah.
Being able to really focus on the magic. And creating an atmosphere with your patter, which it always is. Your act is your patter. Different patter goes in different venues, different situations. I now have a patter for the comedy club circuit if I want to do a comedy club. I have a patter for an intimate small room with, say, 36 people as opposed to the patter that I have when I I just did Major League Baseball Scouts special for ESPN, and there was about, it was at the Beverly Hilton. What does that big ballroom hold?
This is
3,000 or 4,000,
yeah.
I think. And I just did a televised show for them, and it was a different pattern for them. So, man, at this time in my life, I have the correct almost everything to walk into any situation and not be anything more than excited and prepared to give it my all. I'm just so in a good place. There's no questioning what in my mind what I'm going to do. There's no more doubt.
Yeah.
You know, they used to say, when in doubt, leave it out. That's a great motto to live by. But there is no doubt in my mind. I know what I should do, the correct thing to do in any environment that I walk into these days. I'm able to read my crowd that quick and have learned from my experiences in the past.
Well, that's perfect.
So right now it's a few corporate jobs. What is it? Thursday I'm going down to Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
I met a 91-year-old magician. His daughter called the IBM in St. Louis, said, hey, my father's in assisted living now. He wants to do something with his magic. Well, it fell on deaf ears for a while, and then the IBM in St. Louis contacted me. They knew that I had just been the president. I mean, who didn't? And so they said, hey, Mike, this lady's calling us. We don't know who else to contact. Can you help her? Oh, man, I was thrilled. So I drove down to Tucson, and I spent the afternoon with the guy and his daughter, and he's an old magician. He's 91 years old, and he showed me a table that he made, and he gave me all this history, knew all the sky. It's like it was an unbelievable experience. He goes, no, you just take it. I want you to have it. I read your background. I know who you are. You just take it. I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with it just yet. He goes, yeah, you'll get it in the right hands. He goes, I know I passed it off to the right person. I said, okay, so what can I do for you? And his daughter goes, come down and do a show for him at the home where they live. So Thursday I'm driving back down, and I'm going to do a show for these elderly people. Now, that's a crapshoot because I'm an elderly person. I'm 65 now. But I'm going to do a show for people that are my parents' age.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they're not going to all be coherent. They're not going to have energy, and they're probably not going to laugh at a whole lot of stuff, you know. But the two or three that do, hey, I'm a winner in their eyes for that moment. And if nothing else, I gave forth positive effort. And so that's what I'm doing because I have the free time to do it now, and I want to do it.
What a great place in your life. I mean, you know, any younger people listening to this, you know, when you're 25 years old, do you think you're going to be doing that? Probably not. But when you're older, you've gone through enough where now you're prepared for any situation. How cool is that?
I'll tell you something, because I was talking to a young magician the other night, Joshua Jay,
yeah.
Wait a minute. Hold on one second. I want to get this.
Wait, I'm going to tell you because he just contacted me. He said he was just talking to you the other day. Sean Jay?
Yeah, Sean Jay.
Yep.
And so what I'm alluding to is I've had these guys call me. I'm happy to have them call me. Anybody wants to call me and talk about anything, I don't mind. I got time. And we were talking about it, and I said, let me give you a piece of advice then that I did a long time ago. Magicians are some of the good ones, man, they're good at the whole business of magic, and it is a business. I put as much effort into learning that business as I did into learning the magic. It's why I'm where I'm at today. So I told this guy, I said, look, I said, if you can afford it, put $100 a month away. Call your bank. Tell them to direct debit your account every month for $100 and put it in a savings account. Put it in a savings account that you want to forget about, that you don't even care it's there for at least 3 years. Commit to this for 3 years at least. I committed to it for 33 years. But if you can commit to it for 3 years, in 3 years, you're going to have something that didn't cost you anything at the time. But now if you need something, you've got the money to go get it, and you can pay cash for it. And you're not going to spend any more than what it costs,
mm-hmm.
No interest. A lot of times, guys don't plan. They don't, man, how many magicians think, okay, I'm going to do this for 40 years?
Yeah.
You don't become a magician and say, I'm going to do this for 40 years without a lot of luck and without a lot of effort in every facet of this business. Because you and I and everybody listening to this knows the horror stories of magicians ending up dying broke with nothing and having to have people help them with a GoFundMe or whatever. And that's all good and well. But if you'd have planned just a little bit, you'd have got ahead of the game. And so that's the only part that stops so many great magicians from being a complete 100% success story. And I wasn't going to fall for that. I wasn't going to be prepared. It's like if you work at a grocery store or if you work in a factory, you're going to have a 401k. You're going to put some money away for your future, for your retirement. A little hint. I hate to sound goofy about it, but doggone it. I look back and I've been at this 41 years. 41 years I got to do comedy and magic, and I made a living at it. And I made a living at it so much so that I can retire. I can retire, and I hope that I outlive my money, but good chance I might not. I don't need much these days.
No, that's great advice. I remember going to a party of a friend of mine, and there was an older gentleman who they had hired to do the magic for the party. He was, I don't know, my guess is 80 years old. He was preparing his magic kind of in front of the audience, and we could kind of see what he was doing. And it made me sad. And I thought to myself, I am not going to be that guy.
No.
I don't want to be that guy that's doing a kid's birthday party at 80 years old because I have to.
If he was setting himself up like that in front of you, in front of the entire audience, it meant he did not want to be there. He did not have the thrill of being there anymore. You don't set up in front of anybody except yourself in private. And when you're doing that, then you're there and you're walking through the motions. And it is nothing more than just a sad state of affairs. I don't think he intended it to be that way.
No, of course not.
It just, that's where it is, and it's sad, and I am not going to be that guy. No way.
All right, let's not get sad. Let's talk about something cool. Let's talk about your philanthropy. What is the Michael Finney Foundation?
When you've been at this long enough, and everything that we've talked about up to this point led up to this moment, because when you've worked hard, when you've been blessed, when you've been successful, people know who I am in the magic world, and that's great, but I'm still amazed when I go someplace and somebody that I don't know out of nowhere walks up to me and says, "Hey, you're Michael Finney." Obviously, it's a magician person most of the time, but it can be a lay person, but it happens. But I'm still amazed by it. So at some point, you have to say to yourself, how do I give back? How do I give something larger than just my performance or me? Mm-hmm. The only way you do that is through your personal time. So a buddy of mine and I, we've been doing these charity events all over the United States. I've been invited to England to do charity events for very successful soccer players. Howard Keel, the old Broadway actor, did an event over there, and Willie Morgan asked me to come and perform. And I was there with the Moody Blues, and I was there with Don Felder from the Eagles. These guys are giving back. I think I can give back. So we started a little foundation, and our goal was to give immediate care to people, not one of these research foundations, but somebody who could address somebody's issues tomorrow if need be. So we started the foundation, Red Mountain Boys Academy, the John J. Pappas Home for Homeless School for Homeless Children, the Phoenix Fire Department burn camps were the beginning ones. And then we went through Hope for the Warrior. We went through Wounded Warrior Project. We went through the Gift of Life, which gave children open heart surgeries for $6,000 that we would raise. They would open up a kid and give $250,000 heart surgery. So it was an effort to give back through charity with a big party. So we had a two-day golf event, and all of my friends were the celebrities. All of my comedian friends were the celebrities. All my celebrity friends were the celebrities. Glenn Campbell, Alice Cooper, Lance Burton, all the magicians, Jeff Hobson.
Yeah.
They would all come and do the shows for me, Goldfinger and Dove, Foxworthy, Ingvall. They would all come, and they would play in my tournament, or they would perform on the big show. We would raise money and give it away.
Mm.
because I have been given so much, man. I'm not going to dwell on it, but I have a Christian base. And when you give, you will receive. It goes without saying. You don't have to have anything. If you help others, other good things are going to happen to you.
Yeah.
It's the way the world spins. It's the way the world stays balanced. And when things go bad, you can't take it personal. You have to just take it. The strong people are the ones that get up after getting knocked down. Those are the strongest people. And I don't matter if you've been knocked down two or three times. And you may have been knocked down because it wasn't even your fault. Somebody else created something that knocked you down, and you had to get up from a false accusation. You still got to get up. And when you keep doing that thing, when you keep thinking positive, there's nothing but good things can come your way.
You're absolutely right. All right, we're going to go to some fan questions. You want some fan questions?
You know what? I would love to hear the curious stuff from other people, because that's all I got to share nowadays is my experience and what I've been through. And hopefully, if I say one thing that stops somebody from, you know, making a stupid mistake, because, man, I made my mistakes. Gosh darn it. I've apologized for a lot of them, probably a few I still need to apologize for. But doggone it, that's the game of life.
Okay, so here's what happens. Every time I interview somebody new, I put on my Facebook group that you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. And here you are. The first one comes from your friend, Don Barnhart, owner and comedian at Jokester's Comedy Club in Vegas. He asks, what's the scariest place you've ever performed?
Well, he knows. He knows this, and I think it's because it was just a moment in time. He took me on my first Armed Forces entertainment tour. I always wanted to go over like Bob Hope and like Ann Margaret and like all those other celebrities did, but I never had the name. I wasn't a big enough name for anybody to sponsor me, but I would have gone. And Don took me. And he took me because I did do magic and I did do stand-up comedy. But I did do magic, and I could be a little different flavor for the guys. So I went with Danny Villapando, and I went with Paulo Gatta, and Don and I went. And we had the best time. While we were there, we were in Amman, Jordan, the night that ISIS burned the Jordanian pilot in the cage for all the world to see. We were in the city at that time, but when that happened, people came out into the streets, and they weren't protesting. They weren't tearing up. They weren't burning. They were there to get the king of Jordan to come back from the White House, to get him to come back. And he came back that night and flew 16 sorties over ISIS. The military came and got us from the Marriott in downtown Jordan and took us to an undisclosed location right in the middle of it. And I mean, we were clicks from one place and clicks from another place, and both those places were not our friends. We were in range. So yeah, that was probably one of the scariest. And the other one was one night when on my second trip to the Middle East, and I'm with Christian and Catalina, and I'm with Jason Michaels. They took us on a Chinook helicopter at night to an undisclosed location, being shadowed by an Apache helicopter to protect us through a not-so-friendly zone. A lot of these times, they don't tell us the exact locations for our own safety. But yeah, those are probably two of the reality of it all was real.
So when you're on your way there, you're thinking to yourself, oh, well, it's just stuff I've seen on TV. And then you arrive and you're like, oh my goodness, it's actually real.
Yeah, you're in these locations, like in 2008, my son was deployed at Camp Buring, just outside of Kuwait. Don took me to Camp Buring, and I was stood in the same place my son stood, in his office as a provost marshal on that military base. And it was a pretty surreal feeling. 125 degrees, the wind is blowing a minimum of 10 or 15 knots the whole time. I mean, and there's little grains of sand blowing in your face, and you understand why people are covered from top to bottom in that garb to protect you from the elements.
All right, magicians Conrad Colon, Eric Henning, and Dan Chan all said and asked pretty much the same thing. They say, he's a phenomenal MC. Does he have any advice for people who want to hone that skill?
In my lectures, and this is my wheelhouse, in my lectures that I do now, it's very informative. I don't go out and teach a ton of tricks. I have a conversation with magicians. I show them a few specific tricks if they want to learn them, but everything else I try to give good advice. So this is my advice. If you want to become a better MC, learn to do at least 3 to 10 minutes. Try to get 3 to 10 minutes of straight stand-up comedy where you don't have to go on stage with something in your hand. Be able to fill a minute or be able to fill 5 or 6 minutes with nothing more than your mouth. Because when you do that, you expose yourself to people. They get to know you a lot quicker without anything in your hand and just your appearance and the way you're speaking to them. It allows you to endear yourself to them on a very basic human level, and that is speaking and listening. And so, man, here were my role models. Jay Marshall. Mm-hmm. Carol Fox, Charlie Miller, Ab Dixon, and there's other guys. Martin Lewis is also a good MC. Jeff Hodson is a stellar MC. I believe Whit Hayden is a great MC. And in my mind, I could name some other guys, but they can all do something without doing magic as well. And being personable, being yourself, be your character, be that guy. And not everything has to be funny. You can ask questions from the audience. You can tell the audience something that you heard and even get their feedback and let them allow to be part of that MC moment. Now, you may have to repeat their lines. If somebody says something to you from the audience, not everybody in the audience can hear it. If you hear it, right, repeat that line, and then you're able to respond to it, and the rest of the audience will either shake their head in approval or disapproval, but you've allowed it to happen. I just watched guys. I studied them. And a good MC can steal the show. That's what I was told. Carol Fox told me a good MC will steal the show every time. So, man, that's your time to be the headliner and not have to carry the weight of the headliner.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've been to the Comedy Magic Club. That's kind of what we opened this whole talk about. Watched the MC of the Comedy Magic Club and said, that guy's great.
Exactly. And Don Barnhart was the MC at the Comedy Magic Club back in the day.
Oh, maybe I might have seen him then. All right, last fan question. And this kind of brings us back to your Jack Sutherland friend, magician and mustache champion Terry Godfrey. Ask him about the advice Jack Sutherland gave him about performing.
Well, I know why Terry does this. And Terry does this whenever he gets a chance because he wants to inspire people. And so I will just tell you very quickly, when I started out in magic, you know, I was a bartender, so I was pretty gregarious and everything. But I was born with a cleft palate, which is a hereditary birth defect. Nothing you can do about it. It has to do with your parents' genes. So I was that kid that left class every Tuesday and Thursday at like 2:30, 3 o'clock, and I went to speech therapy for a half an hour. And then when I got into high school, I don't even know why I did it. I was led there by something, but I took a public speaking class. A teacher that I knew who was my favorite teacher of all time, my favorite teacher in the world, and he was a U.S. history teacher. He taught public speaking. So I took his class, and I didn't even know why, because I'm a cleft palate. I spoke with a lisp. The last thing I want to do is talk in front of a group of people.
Yeah.
But I did it. I did it. People, oh, you'll never make it. I can remember all the early days. And so when I got into doing the magic and I went to Jack, Jack said, okay, you know you talk funny, right? And I said, yeah, I don't hear it. You do. He goes, okay, so now that we're past that, you got to do something up front to get people to listen to you so they'll learn your cadence they'll learn how you pronunciate certain words and at least give them a chance. And I understood what he was saying to me, but it also made me say to myself, okay, I got to slow down and I got to really pronunciate those bad words. I have bad words that I, you know, the tongue and the lip don't work together against the roof of my mouth.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So Jack said, you're going to do 6-card repeat. He said, it's the worst trick in the world. Nobody does it anymore, but you got to do it. So I did 6-card repeat.
By the way, I like that trick, by the way.
Who spends $600 on a cane and a top hat to do a trick that costs less than a dollar, an old deck of cards? But that's what it did. It taught me to speak correctly, to pronunciate as best I could, to not be afraid. One time during a show, early on, and when I say that, probably within the first 10 years professionally, it was somewhere in a comedy club, and a guy right in the middle of my show, and I could hear it on stage, goes, wow, not bad for a hair lip.
Oh.
I hear this, man, and you could, man, it was dead silence. And this guy said it, and I'm sure he meant to say it to his table, but man, it came up like 3 people deep from the stage. And I was gasping for air. And at that moment, I just said, yeah, but it's all I got, dude.
There it is.
And then I just went on. I didn't know what else to do, so I just went on. And at that point, nobody was ever going to be able to hurt me again.
Hmm.
You get knocked down, and you get back up.
Yep.
So if that inspires you, then it was all meant to be. If it inspires others, it was all meant to be, and I'm happy to share it.
I appreciate you doing my show. This is great. This has been a thrill for me, and it's been you've been amazing.
You know what? I appreciate that very much. At this point, you know, you have to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. I listen to lots of pods and stuff, and people are, man, it's all good stuff. It's all great stuff, and I'm happy to hear about all that. But man, to be a professional entertainer, to do what we do, it takes a lot of sacrifices. It takes a lot of everything that you can muster up. And to stay continued successful at 41 years is incredibly hard. And I tell you that because Lori, I wouldn't have made it without Lori. Lori dotted the I's and she crossed the T's. And when people were mean and were not understanding, she was always understanding. So I think behind every good act, you're going to find somebody that supported them the whole time, 100%. And we owe those people so much because they never get the applause. They never get the standing ovation. So there you have it.
Well, I'm going to give her one right now.
I almost held it together.
You did good. Thanks to all my Variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, spread the word. Tell at least one friend this week. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist. But your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.